Hello, I'm Mary Richards, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which can be heard every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Hello, welcome to the Community Bookshelf on KHOI-FM. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. It was published by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We rejoin the story as the author talks about the immigrant experience of her great-grandparents, particularly that of her great-grandmother, Barbara Marquardt. She saw that they were starting over in the wilderness again. She missed her neat house, the fenced-in yard back in the village, the vineyards, the church, and all the graveyards where her grandparents were buried. When the European settlers arrived in North America, Richard Manning wrote in Grassland, they discovered not the New Testament God of hedged-in villages back in Europe, not the God of logic derived from 30 centuries of civilization. Instead, they encountered the God of Job, Manning wrote, the God of fire and plague, a brutal and capricious creator, like the predecessor God of the Christians, the Old Testament deity that had not yet consented to grace. Is this what drove my great-grandmother to fall to the ground that first day on her new land claim? The realization that she had come face to face with the God of no promises to whom she must prostrate herself. Perhaps this is why Willa Cather noted in O Pioneers that the Bible seemed truer here. And what did my great-grandfather see in the vast emptiness as he stood beside her? By all accounts, he saw only promise and open space. It was almost as if he could reach his hands up and pull down heaven. America, land of opportunity. He had read these words on the broadside posters back in Europe. They were hung on the walls of stores by the railroad companies to lure immigrants to the American West. And now he could see for himself that the posters hadn't lied. In a few months, with the work of his hands, everything would materialize before him. He could see it all now, the endless fields of wheat waving like spun gold in the wind. Chapter 8. Great Falls. Strange things happened to me in Montana, starting with 1976, when my fiancé tried to convince me to move there with him for a job. This was before Montana became the last best place, back when it was still the assignment in Siberia. My single goal in life had been to keep myself east of the 100th meridian. He was just a crazy boy in crazy love with me. I understand that now, these almost 30 years later. Just as I realize now that I loved him crazy back. He was tall and self-conscious about his height, with thin, hunched shoulders and a lean runner's body from the hours of training for the track team. There was a lightness about him. He had a deep voice and an easy laugh, and his hair was shoulder length and streaked gold from the sun. We met in world religions class at junior college, where I was starting just as he was finishing. When he left Bismarck for a track scholarship in another part of the state, I dropped out of classes, hitchhiked across the state, and transferred to a university in his college town all in one day. A few years later, with him, just 20, and me, almost 19, we were mad to be graduated and together in married love. Weren't we just asking for it? Those fevered winter sleeps in his 10th Street apartment in Fargo, our bodies hip point to hip point, turning in the night. my shoulders lining the crook of his arm, his leg thrown over mine, light even in sleep. My chin resting in the hollow of his collarbone, that sweet press of comfort, the comfort of enclosure. And weren't we asking for it that spring weekend when we drove back to visit his parents in Bismarck, 200 miles from our college town, and he took me up that steep ridge near the edge of the city one night and showed me the wide swath of land his wealthy father owned, all of it under development, although there were no streets yet or signs of excavation or gutters or empty paved cul-de-sacs. He stopped the car and had me get out. The headlights shone over this dark expanse, all as yet undifferentiated land, and he pointed out where we would someday live. Our lot would be the choicest spot on the edge, he said, with the good view overlooking the lights of the city. He paced it off for me in the flickering light, the perimeter of the house, where the kitchen would be. Here, the living room. There, the bedrooms, his long arms making wide, drawing motions in the air. He stood beside me and shaped his hands into a frame before my eyes, as if blocking scenes for a film he was directing. I recall smiling at him in the darkness and nodding my head as he spoke. But some panicked part of me was thinking, "Wait, did we talk about this? Where we would live after we were married? What city? What state?" And I thought I foresaw in one bright flash what would be my future life. A fat-faced baby banging a spoon in a high chair, strained carrots on the linoleum, a sky-blue telephone on the wall ringing incessantly. His mother, my mother, always on the other end of the line wanting, I don't know, to exchange recipes? For a moment, I thought I remembered I wanted to be something. A social worker? A rock star? A revolutionary? I wasn't sure which. Here are the ways we lose each other. As soon as we get home, small things go wrong. His father, who owns an empire of businesses sprinkled throughout the West, begins to act like he owns much more. I begin to realize the boy I love receives paychecks each month, unearned, drawn from his father's business. Rich boy, I begin to think. To make things up to me, he goes out and spends an entire month's pay on a diamond opal necklace, my birthstone, and matching opal earrings. He shopped for them for hours, he tells me that night at the restaurant, going from jeweler to jeweler, looking for the right fiery flashes of green to match the precious gems of my eyes. But all I can do is be angry when he doesn't have enough money to pay for dinner, and I'm left to pick up the check. Wasn't he just a crazy boy who would blow all his money on presents and drive himself off a cliff for me? $10, $20, $100, I think about it now. The stupid things we put between ourselves and those we love. Because he came from a soft world, I suppose he didn't know that I could be such a hard girl. Because I was too young, I still harbored a belief that I was invulnerable to any breakage in the world. Weeks later, he tells me we won't be moving to Bismarck after all. His father is grooming him for a job managing one of his businesses in Polson. Polson? I say, afraid to know where we will be sent. Montana, he says, on the southern tip of Flathead Lake. Montana? I begin to hyperventilate. It sounds as if he's drawn the short straw. Things move quickly after that. Within months, we are breaking up and broken up, and I am sleeping with a tall, willowy sprinter from Virginia, just so the crazy boy will understand it's over. He married a girl with long brown hair, someone said, and they moved, after all, not to Montana, but to Bismarck, where he started work in his father's empire. And the house he imagined that night overlooking the city was never built. The couple bought a house, I found out years later, in his parents' subdivision, two doors down from the house where he grew up. And when I heard that small news item, I must admit, I thought to myself, man, I really dodged a bullet there. I have a friend, a traveling salesman, who swears his car breaks down every time he passes Eloy, Arizona, a small town between Phoenix and Tucson on the way to Nogales. Now, each time he gets near Eloy, he's tempted to take a detour. But he tells himself it's pure nonsense, superstition. Then, just as he passes Casa Grande, the engine skips, or the tires begin to thump. The muffler rumbles, and sparks begin to drag on the freeway, or a hose breaks, spewing antifreeze all over the windshield. It's true he's an unreliable narrator of his own stories, and there's no way to check the truth of it. He does drive junkers, which increases the likelihood he'll break down anywhere, including Eloy. Still, I want to believe him, because I know there are places that have memory, that harbor grudges and throw hexes. There are places in the world that have hard-ons only for you, and Montana is such a place for me. The truly strange things that happened to me in Montana began after I dropped out of college in 1977, 8 credits shy of a degree in social work, right after I broke up with the crazy boy who loved me. For the next few years, I moved through bands. Country Western, then a wedding dance band, then rock, then progressive hard rock with a heavy metal band. With music, it's just like what they used to say about drugs. You're always working toward the harder stuff. By my 5th or 6th band, my soprano voice had gone deep and raw from stage screaming, and I was dressing now entirely in black. My hair color and my stage name had been changed, not to protect the innocent, but to protect some idea I had about who I wanted to become. It was the early 80s, and I was living in Rapid City playing with a heavy metal band, a power trio of bass, guitar, and drums, with me up front singing and playing a little keyboard. We toured the West and sometimes Canada in a large black truck, outfitted with couches and cots for resting as we drove, and a large bearing wall in the back half of the truck that held all of our gear in place. The truly strange events that came to pass in Great Falls actually began several weeks earlier, the night before we left Rapid City for a 2-month tour. I lost my driver's license that night, mysteriously, it seemed to me, when I was stopped by a cop for a burned-out taillight in my Plymouth Fury. That was the last I saw of my driver's license, my only form of identification, and I really didn't think twice about it, ever having to prove my identity, until 3 weeks into the tour, when we had a sudden cancellation. A double booking in a club we were supposed to play, and our manager called to tell us he'd found a replacement gig in Canada. It was easy to find last-minute work across the border in the 1980s. Canadians loved American bands, but no one wanted to chance the inspection. With a van full of long hairs and a truck full of equipment, the border guards thrilled at giving their drug-sniffing dogs a run through all your possessions. We'd always gotten through, but you'd hear horror stories of speakers being ripped from cabinets and left on the side of the road, of guitars and soundboards dismantled, and of the inevitable discovery of that lone pot seed nestled in the carpet. You might be there for hours or years. We had been playing in Bozeman, finishing up our week at the Cat's Paw, when the call came about the gig in Calgary. The pay was $1,200 for the week, which was good money then, even though 6 of us had to split it after the 15% came off the top for our manager, and really it was only $1,200 in Canadian currency. We sat in the motel room and weighed our options, which were few. we were going to Calgary. This is the moment when I had to introduce my unique problem, my lack of identification, and all around the room I saw shoulders go limp, jaws go slack. "How could you leave home without an ID?" our light man scolded. I was new to this band, only 4 months. The male singer I'd replaced had a high, airy voice, almost feminine. The band had made 2 albums with him singing all the songs in that high voice until he got married, and his new wife said, buddy, that's all the road life for you. So that's when they came to Fargo looking for me. Because I was in between bands, and my voice was high enough to hit their previous singer's highest high notes. The last 3 weeks on tour hadn't been going well. I was losing my voice from all the hard singing, and for the last few months I'd been messing around with my guitar player, who was unhappily married to his high school sweetheart, a good woman, now a civil engineer, who was happy to support him financially, as well as cook, clip coupons, and clean house, just to support his genius. The guitar player had black hair, long and straight down the small of his back. He had obsidian eyes, dark lashes of eyebrows, and a heavy black mustache that was so long that he could, if he wanted, twist it up on the ends, handlebar style, like those villains in Saturday morning cartoons. He was troubled and brilliant, a classical pianist and classical guitarist, in addition to his heavy metal playing, which was hard and fast and gritty. He harbored a romantic notion of himself, I knew, as Attila reincarnated. When I first joined the band, I would watch him tuning his guitars in his dark corner of the stage, hunched over in some cloud of constantly brooding blackness. Here was someone to test my mettle against. The indestructible girl in me perked up. The real Montana trouble had begun earlier that week in Bozeman. I was taking a bath one night after the gig to wash the sweat and salt from my skin. The guitar player was sitting on the edge of the tub as I bathed. We were discussing the night's performance, what songs had gone well, what needed work. And this is the moment that I chose to give him an ultimatum. The next time we returned to Rapid City, I said, in a calm voice, he would either have to leave his wife or give me up. He shot to his feet and began to shout. I rose in the bathwater and stepped out of the tub naked, somehow knowing it was better to get away from the water. I reached for a towel just as he grabbed me and began to shake me, his thumbs pressing into my arms. My first response was shock. No one had ever touched me this way. My father was an exceedingly gentle man with an explosive temper that he reserved only for the weather and farm equipment. It was slippery on the tiles and cold with my dripping hair, my wet skin and feet. I struggled in his grasp, and that's when the first slaps came, hard on my face, which so surprised me that I began to scream and flail my arms, which only made him pin me tighter against the wall and slap me harder. He was strong, I realized then, so much stronger than I, even as I fumed and bucked against him with my thighs and knees. After some time, after I had no strength left, when I finally went limp, he released his grasp, and we sank to the floor together, both of us crying now. And then a long silence followed. People always speak with impatience about women who stay with violent men, wondering how they could be so stupid. But people don't realize that many violent men, as violent as they are equally gentle afterward. They are so sorry, 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 and each time they managed to convince you it was an anomaly, that it will never happen again. We spent the rest of the night in bed, he on his knees beside me, crying, begging forgiveness, touching my swollen face, the scrapes on my shoulders, the thumbprint bruises on my arms, saying over and over that he couldn't believe what he had done. We didn't sleep. We waited for the sun to come up, and we watched the bruises develop around my left eye and cheek, light blue and pink in patches, and eventually, by morning, a ripe purple half-moon rose under my left eye. I met the band in sunglasses the next morning, making small excuses. The band didn't ask questions. We played out the week like that, with me fronting the band. I sang more ferociously under the harsh stage lights, my bruises covered by the wide rims of dark shades. Road musicians are notorious problem solvers. A few days before we were to leave for Canada, after I'd revealed my lack of proper identification, the guys came up with a solution. All I needed was a certified copy of my birth certificate. But I couldn't call my parents. The arguments I'd had with them over the years about dropping out of college, about bands and breaking up with fiancés and having no money, had left them so disturbed that we had reached an impasse. When I had joined this band, one state away, 4 months earlier, I couldn't bear to tell my parents. I couldn't afford to hear the disappointed sigh on the other end of the line, so I had just packed up and moved to Rapid. Disappearing was easy. I couldn't even be sure they had noticed me gone yet, but I liked to imagine their wild concern when they finally called and found my old number disconnected. How can I explain the wicked pleasure I took imagining their suffering? "They'll be happy to see me when they find me," I remember thinking, "or they'll be sorry when they find me dead." Who was this person, so young and sadistic, and eager to dash herself against the rocks? So to retrieve my birth certificate, I had to call my old fiancé, the crazy boy who once loved me. There was no other choice. He now lived in Bismarck, the city of my birth, the location of the state capital, and the permanent home of my birth certificate. I swallowed hard and dialed the number. It struck me then as amazing that all one needs is the exact arrangement of 7 digits to dial straight into someone's life. The casual hello of his wife's voice on the phone sounded strange and far away. She didn't ask who was calling. He came to the phone in a few moments. I could hear him moving through the rooms toward the receiver, the sound of the television in the background. And then his voice was on the line, still warm and deep and friendly. I explained my situation. Could he go to the state capitol in the morning and retrieve a certified copy of my birth certificate? I asked if he could seal it in an envelope and put it on the Monday morning westbound Greyhound bus, which would arrive in Great Falls, by our estimation, around the time that we were passing through that city, on our way to the northern Montana border crossing in Sweetwater. How many years had it been since we'd spoken? 3 or 4? Yet he agreed easily. It was nothing, he said, a small thing to do for an old friend. Great Falls, despite its lofty name, does not boast Great Falls. A stony ridge marks the cutback of the Missouri as it meanders through the city. On the north side of town, some outcroppings reveal a series of shallow shelves that drop and make their way to the turbines of the Rainbow Dam. This is the part of the Missouri that gave Lewis and Clark fits when they tried to portage it. But that was 200 years ago, in birchbark canoes. We came upon Great Falls in the late afternoon, just as the light was fading. We found the Greyhound bus depot on the crustiest street on the edge of the small downtown. We parked our big black van outside the bus depot and waited for the westbound, which was due in by 9. We laid back and settled in. It was October, and the days were getting shorter and cooler. Our sound man estimated that we could be to the border by midnight. With no delays at customs, we could be to Calgary by morning, just in time to sleep, set up, and play the next night. I felt relieved. Great Falls would be a stopover. In the end, we spent 2 days parked outside that Greyhound bus depot, our truck moving up and down the street in increments to avoid getting a parking ticket. Every 2 hours, our sound man would rouse and crank the engine, pulling a car length forward to the next parking spot, all the time singing "Lovely Rita, Meter Maid" as he did so. Westbound buses came and went at the rate of 2 or 3 a day. People behind the Greyhound counter came to know all of us, shaking their heads no each time we approached, looking for my birth certificate after the latest bus. The westbound buses stopped in Great Falls for short layovers, taking on passengers, then plunged further westward in the night, toward Spokane, toward Seattle. We lived and slept in the van those 2 days, taking turns dozing on the couches and cots. We used the depot facilities, brushing our teeth, washing our faces in the bathroom. Strangers came and went, mounting and dismounting buses, lugging their crying children and heavy suitcases. I spent much of those 2 days in the phone booth, just inside the front door of the bus depot, dialing and redialing the work number and the home number of my former fiancé. Sometime on the first night, he had stopped answering his home phone. Imagine! The next morning, his secretary claimed not to know how to reach him, although I left message after message. Between dialing, I'd retreat to the bus depot bathroom and take off my sunglasses to study the migration of blue bruises on my face. Then I'd return to the phone booth, pull the black accordion door closed beside me, pick up the receiver, and dial again. This would have been my home phone number, I thought as I dialed. If I hadn't been so stupid, this would have been my phone ringing in my kitchen. The days stretched on endlessly. The band took walks, bought giant cookies, got coffee, visited a porn shop down the street, talked to the drunks who congregated and begged for change outside the door of our van. One guy actually said to me, "I'm a quarter away from a gin and tonic," as if he were endeavoring toward some noble goal, like raising funds for better programming on public television. With each westbound that came and went without my identification papers aboard, the guys in the band grew more frosty and impatient. By now, I was hiding in the highest of the back bunks. I was crying, holding a pillow over my stomach and my hand over my mouth so no one could hear my sobs. At one point, I overheard the light man in the front seat saying, "All I know is, ever since she showed up, bad things have been happening." When the guitar player finally found me hiding in the back bunk and saw that I was crying, he asked me what was wrong, and I blubbered, "I miss my cat," which made everyone roll their eyes. Who was this stupid girl, and could we just leave her by the side of the road? She's so many selves away from me. These 25 years later, she's barely recognizable. But I must claim her, that black-haired girl dressed in black with a black eye hidden under dark sunglasses. I feel the tug of recognition whenever I dare to think of her. And this is where we must leave Deborah Marquardt in her odyssey toward growing up. You have been listening to The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt, Professor of English and Director of the Creative Writing Program at ISU. This is the Community Bookshelf. This program is produced by Mary Richards, Assistant Producer Janet Kloss, Program Engineer Ron Latson, and Chief Engineer Rick Morrison. You can listen to the KHOI Community Bookshelf every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Give us comments or suggestions at 515-292-2878 or khoiradio@gmail.com. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening. You have been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening.